Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. This is episode 214 of CJ Evolution, that's Criminal Justice Evolution. This is a podcast for the criminal justice professional out there like you, hosted by me, another criminal justice professional, Patrick here. Thank you so much for tuning in. Special thanks to all those first responders out there, brave men and women who work in the criminal justice field, putting it on the line every day. Thank you for your fantastic work. Keep it up. You know, I'm very excited, like I've talked about many times before, to be partnered with Four Sigmatic, a great company. When I get up in the morning, I have my favorite mushroom coffee. Yes, if you've never heard of this before, it's mushroom coffee made from the good mushrooms, and it tastes amazing. If you head over to cjevolution.com and check out the link to Four Sigmatic, you're going to find amazing products over on their website, and you'll get 15% off of all their products using the promo code CJEVO. You know, we talk a lot about emotional wellness and taking care of yourself physically as well as mentally on the show. I do think, at least where I'm at in Colorado, we need to pay much more attention to this than we do. I think we need to start teaching it more in the police academies. My next guest is an amazing psychologist, and he's going to talk about the importance of emotional wellness. I hope you enjoy the show because it's applicable to everyone out there in the criminal justice field. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I am very excited to have Guy Winch on the show. If you don't know who Guy is, he's a licensed psychologist who works with individuals, couples, and families. He's obviously an advocate of psychological health. He's also a successful author. Guy, are you there, sir?
I am here.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show, sir. I know you're a pretty busy man. I don't think I gave you enough credit with that bio. Do you want to fill in any gaps that I missed?
No, I think that's fine for now. Actually, I've had some TED Talks out and I do speaking, but I think you have the gist of it. And thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, thank you. And I'm so glad you're here. Like I said, you know, you're an advocate, obviously, for psychological health. I think it's so important. We talked a little bit off the air that I think we need to talk about this more, especially in criminal justice. And I know, sir, that you have talked to law enforcement groups and you know, agencies. Can you tell us a little bit about those discussions that you've had with working with law enforcement? What do they center around?
They do center around this issue of emotional health and paying attention to it. And I would like to say, you know, improving it, but it really, we're at the level of we need first to start paying attention to it and literally just asking ourselves how we're doing and monitoring that in a certain way. I think what happens with law enforcement is, and with there are a bunch of careers like that, but law enforcement, I think especially, is that the assumption is, yes, this is going to be very stressful and this is going to have a lot of very challenging moments psychologically speaking, that's kind of what you're signing up for, so just suck it up.
Yeah.
So in other words, and therefore, if you're actually talking about or admitting to any stress or distress, then maybe you're not suited for this. Mm-hmm. Might be some of the feedback people get or might be some of the concerns that they have. And there is a little bit of that culture in law enforcement and in other careers as well. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that these things are not mutually exclusive. You can actually express distress in a way that you get help and shore up any kind of weak spots in a way that doesn't actually mean that you're not coping. It's actually, to me, a way of coping rather than a way of not.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're exactly right, Guy, because I think there still is a culture out there in law enforcement and criminal justice where maybe it's a sign of weakness, you know, that you're admitting that, you know, or you're telling people that you're having some issues. I do think it's changed, though, since I've been doing this for 21 years, and I think it's gotten a little better. I still think we need to spend more time talking about it. Because, as you know, sir, I mean, if we don't talk about these things, you know, and get these out in the open with somebody like you who's an expert, they're going to manifest themselves out in different ways throughout our lives, correct?
They're absolutely going to manifest, and they're going to spill over into our personal lives, mm-hmm. and they're going to spill over into our parenting and into our relationships with our partners and our spouses, mm-hmm. and that's going to be a problem. And talking about it really has to start from the top. It really has to you know, there needs to be, anytime you want to change a culture, it really has to start from the top. Otherwise, it's going to have a hard time taking root. And I'll give you just a very silly example. When I give talks to law enforcement, I typically leave time for a Q&A at the end, which most people do. And then I found that on my topic of emotional health, if I leave time for a Q&A, I won't get a lot of cues. And so I have an intermission where I allow people to write their questions into a box anonymously, which I then open and read and respond without saying who asked the question. And then I get a lot of questions. In other words, even asking the question feels iffy in front of colleagues. And that means something. That means something about the culture and about how difficult it is to actually speak up and how difficult it is to actually talk about these things at the moment.
And it seems like you have a great, I love that, which you do, because that seems like the icebreaker, and that's what gets people talking is, okay, the first guy went or the first woman went, they asked the questions and, you know, the doctor is answering them. Now I can, I feel comfortable enough to ask some questions.
That's right. And in other kinds of, I've worked also, let's say, with mining companies who also have a lot of stresses and a lot of certain physical dangers in their jobs as well. And I actually, before I give talks, I ask the most senior person in the room, who was going to be, to ask the first question. And I say, I really don't care what you ask me. Ask me my favorite song. Just ask something, because once, you know, a senior person asks it in the room, then it gives it a little bit of permission to other people. But the goal here is that our emotional health is very much impacted by our day-to-day, by what we do, by stresses, and it very much bleeds over into our physical health as well. So it's not even really just about emotional health, because a lot of the things I talk about, I bring a lot of numbers and statistics about how this is actually impacting your physical health as well, and in sometimes shockingly detrimental ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you, when you talk to people, doctor, I mean, how do you get through to people that they have to change or they should change, like senior administrators, for example, like you go talk to corporations, you go talk to law enforcement executives. You're exactly right. It all starts at the top. It has to come from the top down. But how do you get, because I think you probably get some pushback, I imagine. I mean, how do you try to get through to people? I mean, ultimately, it's on the individual. I get that. But how do you try to say, look, this is, how do you do it? This is so important. I mean, it just seems like it just falls upon deaf ears from my point of view, from what I observe sometimes with executives in law enforcement. They don't pay enough attention to it.
Right. And so I actually, in my first TED talk I did, which is called Why We Need to Practice Emotional First Aid, is really, it just lays out in 17 minutes this argument for why that is important. And it's a pretty persuasive, I mean, I tell it through stories and through anecdotes and I add jokes in, but really it's a quite persuasive argument about here's what happens when you ignore this. And this is what happens to all of us. And here's what we actually know about how these things operate. And then I talk about statistics. Now, I'm just going to give an example. Just, you know, a random one, but I talk about, let's say, loneliness. It can be when the stresses of our job get significant. A lot of the times our response to it when we get home is that we just don't have anything left over. So we kind of retreat from our family, from our spouse. We kind of, we're just quiet, we retreat, we just don't have the strength to, the emotional strength or the energy left to interact, to start having a deep discussion. And over time, people can be in marriages and can be in families, but find themselves emotionally really disconnected. And that essentially is what the definition of loneliness is. It's not a subjective thing about how many people are around you. It's an objective thing, rather. It's a subjective standard about how connected or disconnected you feel. And when you get to a certain point of disconnection and you become lonely, there is a very massive physical response to that. Your immune system becomes repressed. Your body goes into fight or flight. And over time, chronic loneliness leads to, raises your chances of having an early death by anything from like 14 to 20 something percent, depending on the study.
Wow.
In other words, you will literally die sooner. You have a significantly greater chance of cardiovascular disease and all kinds of other illnesses because your immune system is being suppressed. In other words, there is a very tangible, real impact on your health and your longevity. And this is about loneliness. And the American Psychological Association put out a press release last year saying that loneliness is now a greater health risk than obesity and smoking combined. And yet most people don't know it. Most people don't pay attention to it. But it's just an example of how these soft psychological, quote-unquote, emotional things have very real-world consequences.
Mm-hmm. And when you were talking, and that is, it's so important what you just said, but we're really, one of the things that stuck out to me, Guy, what you just said is, you know, how we come home and shut down, and we don't want to talk about it.
Right.
I've done that so many times. I mean, not recently, but I have. And I start thinking of, you know, maybe I've had a hard day at work, and I start coming down on myself, and I start putting myself down, or I start thinking negative thoughts about, you know, I can't do this job, I'm not doing it right, whatever. And to your point, and it's so hard to get out of that rut sometimes. And thankfully, I have a good support system in my wife and my family. But yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, one of the things that I've worked on over the years is just put myself down. I mean, that negative self-talk, and that's probably a big piece of it.
Yeah, let me say something about that, because boy, is that common, the negative internal self-critical dialogue, mm-hmm. That we all have at different moments. And my thought about that is as follows. When I ask people, what is the benefit of that? Mm-hmm. I understand these are just thoughts, but you do indulge them. You do kind of allow that script to run on in your head. What benefit does it possibly do for you? Mm-hmm. Like, really, what is the plus? Is there any upside whatsoever? Yeah. And people struggle with that, but they'll say, well, it kind of just makes me more ready, or makes me... I'm like, no, it doesn't. It impacts your self-esteem. It impacts your motivation. It's demoralizing. It's depressing. It saps your energy. It saps your sense of efficacy and efficiency. Mm-hmm. It's just damaging. And yet we really indulge it. And what I say to people is, in the same way, if a friend hung out with you, and the litany from their mouth about you was, really, you're not handling this well, are you really cut out for this job, are you sure you really can do it, it's probably not good enough for this, you're really screwing up all the time, you would not hang out with that friend, mm-hmm. because that would be such an unpleasant experience. Mm-hmm. Why would you tolerate that in your own head?
Yeah.
Especially when you have the ability to shut it down. Now, people say to me, I can't shut it down, because that's the voice I'm hearing in my head.
You can.
Here's a key point. Yeah. Here's a key point. A, you have to be aware of it, number one, and catch it. And B, if it's hard to shut the voice off, just distract yourself by doing something else.
Yeah.
We literally cannot parallel, you know, process. So if you suddenly engage yourself in, I don't care if it's Candy Crush, but if you're serious about it, you won't. That voice will be quiet because you're doing something else. You have to develop this zero tolerance for the self-critical voice.
Yeah. And I think it's so important, like you said, Guy, is, you know, you need to have positive people in your life. It's so easy to fall in that, what is that, the saying, where the average of the five people that we associate with or something like that. It is so important, at least in my opinion, that we surround ourselves with people that are going to lift you up, not keep you down.
Exactly. And one thing I say is, this is an example I use to everyone, but it might be more apt right now for your audience, is that I say that you really have to assume the mantle of a detective in certain things, because the idea of not allowing the self-critical voice doesn't mean you shouldn't try and look back on mistakes or failures and figure out what you can do differently and better next time. That's actually learning from errors, learning from mistakes, learning from failures. Those are very, very important things. But you need to do it like a detective. And since I'm not a detective, my stereotype of a detective is that they're unemotional. They don't enter a crime scene and go, can you believe the blood spatter on that wall? They're not that excited about it. They're just like, they're noting it.
Yeah,
but it doesn't have this big emotional overlay. And it has to be the same thing when you're inquiring about, all right, I didn't get the promotion, or I screwed up in this place or in that. So dispassionately look at what you need to take from that, what you need to learn from that. Mm-hmm. But the self-criticism adds nothing to that. It'll just discourage you and distract you from the actual learning you need to do in the scenario.
Yeah, it's such a good point. We hear a lot about, and we're starting to hear it a lot more in law enforcement and criminal justice, we hear about the importance of having emotional intelligence. Can you tell us about what your definition of emotional intelligence is, Guy?
So the general definition of emotional intelligence is about having a understanding of emotional and social dynamics, having an understanding of your strengths and weaknesses, having some kind of observing eye about how you're coming across, being able to figure out the dynamics politically and otherwise of where you are. Because really the studies show that, you know, two people with equal ability and equal performance might have very different careers based on social intelligence, because the one with the emotional intelligence is going to be much more observant about how to connect and who to impress and how to conduct themselves and what to present. And so they'll have an advantage there. So that's the general definition. For me, it's much more about having a finger on the pulse mm-hmm. of your emotional life. Like, so when you feel stressed or distressed or depressed or anxious, or when you're coming home and you're not able to stop ruminating about whatever the case was that's really bothering you, and you can't shut that off. So emotional intelligence means you have to recognize, mm-hmm. I'm not going to be productive at 2 o'clock in the morning lying in bed thinking about that case. Yeah. It's just not going to be the best use of my time. A much better use of my time will be to sleep. So if there's something I really need to think about, I'll make a note for myself and I'll schedule it to think about it in a specific time in the morning. So I know that's taken care of. And then I will absolutely try and focus on sleep. When I'm feeling really anxious about whatever else is going on or really stressed, I will address that or I will recognize that, so I know that that might impair my judgment, my decision making, which it does. You know, we are a computer. Our brain is a computer that has a finite amount of computing power. So when you are feeling stressed or anxious, or when you're ruminating about something problematic, that is leeching resources that you would probably need to use in your job. Mm-hmm. And it's leaving you less of them. Even with IQ testing, if somebody's depressed, they're going to test probably 10 to 15 points lower in their actual IQ because they are not able to bring to the fore their real abilities. And so we have to understand that this emotional stuff is actually impacting our performance. It's leeching IQ points when we're not taking care of it. It's leeching our ability to focus, to pay attention to capacity. It's absolutely impacting our ability to do our jobs proper.
Yeah, and you're so right about the sitting up. I've done it. You know, people out there listening have probably done it too. I mean, you sit up at night trying to think about stuff, and you're not getting any sleep. You're waking up the next morning exhausted. You're going into work, especially in our line of work, extremely dangerous to get to that point where you're out there patrolling or do whatever you're doing out there in criminal justice, and you're not taking care of yourself like we've been talking about.
Correct. And I talk to people as, like, anxiety, for example. I'm going to talk about that for a minute. You know, anxiety presents itself in very compelling ways because it's the feeling of dread that physiologically, really in your body, in your mind, really feels like there's something very emergent about to happen, that there's a real danger on the horizon. Except the difference between anxiety and fear is, it's fear, you can actually see the person, you know, who's dangerous in front of you. With anxiety, there is no actual danger. It's something that got triggered incorrectly by your body. And so people typically, just this week, somebody said to me that, you know, they woke up at 3 a.m. and they were really worried about whether their kid would get into college. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them and I said, that's anxiety. And they said, well, how do you know it's anxiety and not real worry? I said, because your kid's 8.
That's a good point.
So
you got some time to think about that.
Not so relevant at the moment. You know, I mean, or I'm really worried about my retirement. You're 32.
Yeah.
You know,
well, it's okay to talk. It's okay to think about that stuff, I guess. Like, you know that guy. I mean, but you don't have to dwell on it.
Right. My thing is, that's 2 a.m. That's not the time for that.
Yeah.
And again, when there's when we're self-reflecting in this way, there are healthy ways to self-reflect and there are unhealthy ways to do it. And people always say to me, you're a psychologist, so aren't you thrilled when people are self-reflecting in any way? And I'm like, no. Yeah. Because in some ways it's good and in some ways it's bad. And when you're just looping or ruminating about the same thing over and over again, there's nothing that comes of that.
Yeah.
So, but if you're going to sit and problem solve, literally problem solve, ask yourself, what can I figure out here? What kind of perspective can I take? How can I address this? You're actually trying to address a problem. That's usually productive. It's not productive when you're just replaying the image of the, you know, the boss screaming at you at work and you just can't get it out of your mind. You're just going over and over and over it again. That's rumination. It's not useful problem solving.
Yeah. And it's like you talk about, Guy, that's emotional first aid, recognizing it and taking care of it at the moment.
Right. And I think that the main point there is that, I mean, what caused me to write my book, Emotional First Aid, is I was reading the literature, reading the scientific journals, and finding, oh, wow, there's all these great studies about what you need to do when you get rejected, or how you manage failure, or what cognitive distortions happen in our perceptions when certain situations happen. And yet they're written in this, just even psychologists would have a hard time. It's just for other researchers. They're not written for, oh, here, public at large, try this. Mm-hmm. And so I started, you know, taking these findings and translating them into actual action that my patients could take, and finding that, oh, this was very useful. That was very useful. And then I decided to write a book about, okay, here's how we can treat common emotional wounds, just little small actions we can take in the moment to make sure they don't get quote-unquote infected. They don't get worse, that they don't really spin out of control. Yeah. And that's the idea. We would do that if you have a cut. Most of us are going to cover it with a bandage because we don't want it to get infected. It is really the same principle for emotional wounds.
So you talk about a bunch of important things, Guy, but how do you teach people to become more resilient or build their self-esteem when they're at a place that is very low?
So resilience and building self-esteem, they kind of go hand in hand in certain ways. Resilience is about more than just building self-esteem, because just for example, if you learn how to manage failure and learn from it and assume that it will teach you something every single time, then the next time you fail, you'll be more resilient to the failure emotionally, because you'll know that, oh, it sucks at the moment, but I'll be able to figure something out. Mm-hmm. With self-esteem, you know, it's as follows. When our self-esteem is low, a couple of negative things happen. We become resistant to compliments or to positive feedback, because we're thinking poorly of ourselves, and the positive feedback contradicts our internal feeling of the moment. So if you're feeling like super incompetent and someone comes and says, you are doing such a bang up job, you look at them like, are you kidding? Are you joking? Are you ripping me right now? What's that about? And they actually might have meant it, because there was that one thing you did well, which they knew about and didn't know about the other stuff. So, you know, we become resistant to compliments, which is unfortunate because we need them. But B, we tend to perpetuate it. And when our self-esteem is low, the bulk of the damage we do is really self-inflicted. Mm-hmm. We just go around, you know, being very negative about ourselves, being very self-critical, and then cherry-picking data. And everything that goes slightly wrong is confirmation that we're incapable, or we're this, or we're that. And everything that goes right gets dismissed as, well, that's just chance, so it doesn't really matter, that one. And so the important thing about self-esteem is you actually have to purposefully take action to revive it when it's low. Mm-hmm. You actually have to make that a little bit of a project. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I'll just give this example because it's very generic, and I don't want to give examples from law enforcement because I'm not sure what I want to make a scenario that would be incorrect. Mm-hmm. But let's say, you know, in a romantic setting, you get, you know, you're going out with someone, she dumps you, and you're feeling really bad about yourself, and you're feeling like, I'm just never going to find someone. I'm not attractive enough, smart enough, rich enough, blonde enough, big enough, small enough, whatever it is. When to revive your self-esteem in that moment, you should make a list of the qualities that you know you have, that are meaningful in relationships, and you know they are. So you might be a very social person. You might be someone who's a good listener. You might be someone who gives great back rubs or makes great muffins or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, but if you make a list like that of things you know people will find valuable, and then you choose one of those items and you write a paragraph about why this is important, why how you've displayed that in the past, how you might display it in the future, what that thing does. It's called self-affirmation. You're affirming aspects of yourself you know to be true. But that reminds you of what you do bring to the table. Our default mechanism after rejection is to remind ourselves of everything we don't bring to the table, everything we don't have. And that is exactly the opposite of what we should be doing. So that exercise forces us to focus on what we do.
Exactly. So important. Now, what kind of a different route really quick. What was the catalyst in your life? Did you always want to help people, Guy? I mean, how did you get on this path that you're, because you're doing such amazing work. I mean, what was the catalyst in your life? Did you always know you wanted to do this?
Look, I'll tell you the story. I'm an identical twin. We're only two of us, me and my identical twin. And that's that first TED talk about emotional first aid is about my relationship with my identical twin. Okay. But I'll give you a spoiler from the talk. He is also a psychologist.
Okay.
And in a way of answering your question, my mother once said to me, she said, you know, your brother and you always wanted to be psychologists. What does that mean if both my sons wanted to be psychologists? And I said to her, well, I guess it means you've done either everything right or everything wrong. And she says to me, well, which is it? You know,
that's
like,
funny.
You have to ask.
That is so funny. Can you talk about, you mentioned one book, Guy, Emotional First Aid. Can you mention some other books that you have out there that people can grab if they want to?
Yeah, my first book is called The Squeaky Wheel. It's essentially about the psychology of complaining, something we all do. My last book is also has a TED Talk associated with it. It's called How to Fix a Broken Heart. And the book is about two kinds of grief that are very disenfranchised, and that is romantic heartbreak and pet loss. If you're over the age of 20 and you're in a serious relationship, but you're not married and you get dumped, very few of us are going to go to work and say to our boss, I need the day off because my girlfriend dumped me. We are even less likely to go in and say, I need a day off because my cat died. Except that that cat could have been with you for 25 years and been with you through the ins and outs of every dramatic moment of your life. Sure. And you interacted with that cat on a daily basis. And we know from research that people, when they lose pets they're close to, go through very authentic grief reactions, except we don't sanction them in society. It's not recognized. It's not, you know, like a close friend will go, oh, I'm sorry. But we can really be broken from those things. And we feel, and every time I work with someone who's going through it, they always apologize and say, I know this is silly, but. And it is absolutely not silly. And because those cause grief reactions, romantic loss can cause huge grief reactions, literally very, very profound emotional responses. Anyone who's been heartbroken, if they think back to it, will remember how absolutely centralizing that was. There was absolutely no question in the first throes of heartbreak that they're not going to be able to go to work and function normally, except they don't have an option. So they have to call and make a sick day or pretend they have a cold or something because they can't just say, my heart just got broken. And my thought about that is that, A, we need to recognize things as legitimate forms of grief, and then we actually have to recognize that we need to indeed grieve and grieve correctly so we can move through it and recover.
Good points. Now, I'm going to have all your books, and I'm going to have the TED notes linked up in the show notes after the show, Guy. Is there any final thoughts that you would give the listeners before we leave?
Yeah, and my thought about it is this. We all have different stuff that is troubling us. Some people might have anxiety. Some people might be ruminators. Some people might have conflict at home. Whatever the emotional challenge is or psychological one that you're facing in your life, there is so much information out there. So you could start in private. Start, you know, Google some stuff, read some articles, listen to some TED Talks, get some perspective, get a sense of what we know as a science, because there's a lot we know as a science, and get a sense of what you need to be aware of or what you can actually do. But since it's difficult to start by just talking to other people, start by getting informed yourself. And this is about self-help. So you can do that in private, but do it. Don't, you know, if you need to erase your history because you don't want, you know, your wife to see that you looked up anxiety, erase the history if you must. But be diligent when there's something that's really bothering you and it's not getting better. When you are emotionally distressed, you can do something about it. And I would really urge people to take action.
Yeah. Well, Guy Wendt, sir, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was very informative. We wish you the best of luck in the future, sir, and we hope you have a great day.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, Guy. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.